You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 245, ETS Interviews, Part 4. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Well, Mike, we're still here.
We are still here.
Quattro, four. I guess this is a magical episode, if that makes sense, but it doesn't. But we've got two Carls for this show, one with the C, one with the K. Maybe yep. We should rename this show.
Yeah, well, we could, whatever yeah. You want to do.
All right.
Yeah. Now, on the episode, though, we have Carl Sanders. That's the Carl with a C, and Ron Johnson. Again, listeners will probably recall that we talked to Carl and Ron last time, sort of just riffing on some theological topic. And we decide we're going to do that again. You know, and we picked a different topic, and I think people will find it interesting and useful. And I don't think it's a stretch to say, you know, we'll all learn something. So I think that'll be, again, provide some good insights as to the kind of conversations that people have here. And, you know, scholars just love to talk shop. So you get a little glimpse into that. And then Carl with a K is Carl Kutz and Rebecca Josberger. They both teach at Multnomah, and they have come out with a new Hebrew grammar. And I wanted to have them on specifically because Carl had taught a class that I was in at the University of Wisconsin in Madison at the beginning of my doctoral program, what the department sort of cast as a second-year Hebrew class. And his approach to Hebrew was kind of unique, and it has sort of earned a reputation as being a method that really prepares people better for serious, you know, scholarly study, graduate study in Hebrew in programs around the country, but then also, you know, for just pastors, you know, to sort of learn the language a little bit in a better way, learn how to read Hebrew, learn how to just handle things better. And I know everybody says their grammar is different. In Carl's case, and Rebecca, his teaching partner, and she also teaches Hebrew there at Multnomah and has sort of adopted and furthered Carl's methodology. This new grammar, I think, is going to gain a reputation as probably the premier tool for learning biblical Hebrew in the first year. So we wanted to have them on and sort of introduce that book to our audience. Because again, a lot of people in the Naked Bible audience want to learn Greek and Hebrew, and here's a good chance to get in on the ground floor of an important new resource. Well, welcome back. Again, we're in Denver at the annual meetings of the Evangelical Theological Society. And for our audience, we have, again, two familiar voices. You have heard them probably every year we've done this. Carl Sanders is with us to my immediate right, and to the far right is Ron Johnson. We want to, even you know, for the sake of people who aren't you know familiar with either of these two, since the podcast grows, that happens. Ron might be more familiar than Carl because Ron has been rolling out this series, you know, with the Bible's Big Story on the blog. But again, for those who need to get caught up, I'm going to ask both of you to briefly introduce yourself. Carl, we'll go first with you. And then we're going to sort of throw something to the wind like we did last year. Go ahead, Carl.
All right. Okay. Yeah. My name's Carl Sanders. I'm a professor of theology at Capital Seminary I'm located in the Washington, D.C. area. We're connected with Lancaster Bible College up in Lancaster, PA, but I'm in a satellite campus. I've taught at a number of different schools, various venues.
What do you teach?
I teach theology primarily. Yeah. I do some stuff with theology of culture recently, quite a bit with that, technology and things like that.
You're so trendy, Carl.
Isn't that trendy? It's amazing. I also, oddly, have written a paper that was published last year on Greek pedagogy. So yeah, how I got to that from
with theology. Peter Gurry, we had an interview with Peter earlier.
Yeah, I didn't do it with Peter, and Peter is not necessarily a fan of my approach.
Oh, okay,
but he's like most Greek professors. They look at me and they say, "Why are you writing about
right.
this?" But anyway,
what are you doing?
And I've known Mike for a long time, and Ron I've known for a long time as well because he's my brother-in-law too. So
you didn't marry my sister.
No. Married my sister.
There we go. He can't remember his family relationships. This is not starting well.
We've had lots of common friends and common enemies.
Some of that is.
Yeah. I currently don't teach or pastor right now, but
It's probably actually nice. You know, you
I'm a free agent.
To not take things back, you know, home with
I'm
you
a total
and all
free
that.
Agent, which is a it's different. It really is different. You don't sense any nervousness when you say things anymore.
Right.
And,
so
and there
so,
always was that whenever you
I mean, you're teaching in your local church.
Yes, but it's a very it's a non-denominational church and very welcoming of the moving of the Spirit.
Okay.
So I can say what's right. on my heart and my path is more important than my destination.
Okay.
In this church which I love, so.
All right, well, speaking of the Spirit, you
the transition you, for you.
Right, there's a nice little segue for us. You had two or one?
Two papers.
Two that papers I that were rejected submitted. This year. So we want to talk about those.
And I don't know. I'm not going to presuppose bad reasoning, but there's a lot of papers here.
They got a lot of them,
so,
yeah.
But I thought at least one of them was right on target. The other one was called The Big Story of the Bible. I was simply going to take my blog that I'm okay. doing with you and get it done in time for a paper. Which I do need to get it done anyway because I'm teaching on it at church in January.
Okay.
So, but that was summarily rejected. I'm not sure why.
See, I would comfort you by saying I've had papers rejected, but that's probably not really comforting.
Well, I think we all have.
Not right now.
And sometimes the ones that I think are the best get rejected. So yeah. There you go.
But the second one I thought was right on topic. I entitled it something like The Corporate Coming of the Spirit. And my thesis, and I wrote it down here, is that the Old Testament would have prepared people in the New Testament for not an individual coming of the Spirit into them, but instead a corporate coming of the Spirit upon groups, thus indicating that they're in the family of Abraham. So I thought it worked well, but again, maybe just for time or for size, it didn't fit. But
well, that, it's a good topic to discuss because this is one of those topics that there are a lot of, maybe not a lot, but there are several crucial questions and really not a whole lot of clear answers. So the whole topic of the Old Testament and the Holy Spirit or the Holy Spirit in the Old Testament is usually how it's phrased. I mean, to me, that topic is connected with what's new about the new covenant. Because
right.
if you go back and you look in Ezekiel passages and Jeremiah, these two things are very obviously connected, that the new covenant has something to do with the Holy Spirit. And, you know, you get to the New Testament, and you could point to, oh, there's Acts chapter 2, or there's this passage or that passage. But then once you get into the topic, then other questions that are related come up like, well, if people in the Old Testament weren't indwelt, then how could they be, you know, the people they were, you know, in terms of godliness? Because we get this New Testament talk about, you know, the flesh versus the spirit, and you know, you need to be spirit empowered to follow, to be godly and whatnot. So it's sort of, while you're creating one connection that looks really good, you're creating a disconnect somewhere else. And that's just sort of how this one goes. So what do you guys...
Can I give you my four propositions? Which
let's
hear
them.
Let's start with that.
And then you can...
And then we can disagree with them.
That's what we did last year, I think, too.
Proposition number one, the Old Testament individual loyalist was eventually, by the time you get to the end of the Old Testament, considered to be a part of a corporate group. It's variously known as remnant or elect or his people, God's family, something like that. So that's proposition number one. I don't think there's any debate about that. Just a textual flow of the argument. So number two, it was to this corporate group that Jeremiah and Ezekiel promised a new heart and spirit, and Joel 2 as well. I will put a new spirit among you, is the actual phraseology, not in you, but among you.
Okay.
So my two propositions so far coming out of the Old Testament would be that an individual indwelling would have been off the radar of the Jewish mind. They wouldn't have been thinking about that. Number three, Jesus told Nicodemus that being born from above, or again, was a corporate promise from Ezekiel 38 and dry bones. Marvel not that I say to you, ye, it's plural, you must be born again. I think Nicodemus would have taken the shock value of that to say that Israel, in Jesus' opinion, had to undergo a transformation of loyalty in order for the kingdom to really come. Of course, he misunderstood this as a new birth, you know, in the physical sense. But I'm arguing in number three that Nicodemus fell into line with that corporate understanding of the Spirit.
So,
thus
yeah.
a new heart. Thus
so there's some sort
in.
Of corporate transformation.
Right.
Okay.
He wouldn't have understood that, nor did Jesus mean it to be an individual rebirth.
Okay.
Number four, at Pentecost, the coming of the Spirit was interpreted by Peter to fulfill the corporate promise of Joel 2. Again, as you read Acts 2, I don't sense that... See, that's, and where you can justly argue with me is, well, doesn't corporate include individual?
Yeah.
I would say not if the word among...
What's the preposition there, do you know?
En humin, and it's usually translated okay. Among. Why couldn't it be among you? Or, well, just think of Acts 2 again. At Pentecost, this corporate sight of tongues of fire.
How about the Old Testament passage? What's the preposition there? Do you know?
Kerub.
Okay. So it's the same one in Psalm 82.
Yeah.
Among, yeah. Right.
So that's my thesis, my idea. Each subsequent coming of the Spirit in Acts 5 times and in all of Paul's letters is speaking to this corporate identification of God's hand of approval upon a group, noticeably the Gentiles, as Paul is moving through their cities. And one by one, as the Spirit comes en humin among you, that's how it'll say it in the epistles, among you, plural. But as you see it in Acts being played out narratively, it's a corporate thing. Nobody personally does something to show the Spirit coming inside of him. It's simply a way of the writer saying that the Spirit came to this group and then this group, and when he comes to you in the epistles, I would still take that as a corporate thing to the Galatians or Ephesians or whatever, that they remembered then, when Paul would say the Spirit among you, they would think back to the day in their community that whether through Paul or some other apostolic figure.
Just the laying on of hands?
The laying of hands for Timothy. That there was some kind of visible moment where before usually a Jewish audience, or at least Jewish eyes, a Gentile or a Gentile group was approved as participating in the new covenant through this coming of the Spirit, usually associated with signs.
Some sort of discernible event or happenstance.
They saw the grace of God, it said one time.
Yeah.
As though it must have been physically interpreted. Yeah. Well, that was the thesis of my paper. So,
right, Carl.
Well, I mean,
Carl? Were you on the committee that rejected this?
Exactly. No, I'm on no committees. I just received the rejections. I mean, there's a lot of things I like, or elements of this I really like. I mean, I certainly think, you know, what happens in Acts specifically is quite clear that the Spirit, the pouring out of the Spirit is always meant to be a sign, really, of something new, of entrance into this new covenant realities, new covenant communion for Gentiles. So, and that's exactly how Peter argues in Acts 10 and 11, right? He says, we saw what happened. Who are we to say no to this, right? And it's interesting, I think, as well, when you look at Cornelius, and I'll just focus on that story for a minute, because Cornelius is a God-fearing Gentile. So I'd consider him... You know, saved, if you want to use that language.
He's a believer.
He's a believer, right. Yeah. He's righteous. So this is not a conversion story in one sense in Acts 10, although it's often preached that way.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a paper on that in the past. That one did.
And I would call that a sacred space story to bring up the blog. I would call it a sacred space moment in Acts 10 and 11 where Peter gets the vision and you go through all this stuff and the Holy Spirit sanctifies Cornelius in the model that's being played out there.
He has faith, but it needs to be, I don't know if the right word's directed or the object of faith needs to be clarified.
The metaphor I use in my classes is it needs to be upgraded.
Okay.
Software, you know, so he gets upgraded to the new covenant reality, the new covenant experience of salvation. Because obviously he's a believer, but he's a Gentile believer. So, I mean, he's already... You know, he's kind of on the fringes in some respect because he's not directly part of the covenant community. So he's got what we might call salvation, but not the full experience. And so there's something that's happening in Acts where Jews and Gentiles are now both experiencing this new reality.
How about
that's
the epistles then? That's where I'm curious agree with me on the epistles.
In some places I would. It's interesting. Someone told me, and I wasn't there, so if I misspeak, I apologize to Walt Kaiser right now. But he did a paper where I think he was arguing for corporate indwelling as being the predominant metaphor. So at least someone told me that just there. So in light of our conversation about this earlier, I thought of that. So, I mean, this is not a new idea.
How about filling of the Spirit then? See, to me, you could get away from this individual, or even fruit of the Spirit. When Paul brings that up, notice how relational those fruits are. They're not me personally sitting in a room getting filled by this inanimate being.
The gifts of the Spirit are not the filling of the Spirit, because the gifts tend to be, you know, not every Christian is going to have the same gift.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Whereas the fruit of the Spirit, that's obviously corporate.
It's interesting, yeah, though, even there is this corporate focus in the New Testament that we miss a lot just because we're Westerners. Yeah.
Do you think there's any personal relationship?
I suspect there's at least something. I mean, and I'm going to go to 1 Corinthians 6 as my one passage that I think maybe hints at that, because he's talking about your body being a temple of the Spirit. So don't engage in immorality.
Right. Your body's right. Sacred space.
Your body is sacred space.
Just as the corporate body is sacred space.
So there may be, I don't know, it has to be an either or. It could be a both and. There could be both realities. I certainly think the corporate thing is often missed. And I think I mentioned this the other day. We were talking that I have students all the time who quote 1 Corinthians 3 as a passage talking about how we individually are God's temple. And if you read 1 Corinthians 3, it's obviously that's the corporate reality, mm-hmm, the church. The problem there is the division of the church. And if you're dividing the church, you're transgressing Christ's body and you're subject to judgment. So there certainly is that there. So I think it's interesting that in 1 Corinthians, where I read it as being a very communal corporate book for the most part, I mean, there's these hints of individuality. I think 1 Corinthians 6 might work. But I think that's... the corporate is something we're really lacking a lot. So
how about Nicodemus and the born again being corporate?
That one I haven't thought about in the same way.
If it's plural, that's very interesting, because he would sort of be speaking to the Jewish community, again, through this proxy.
Yeah, and the other tricky thing, of course, there always is, this is John reporting this to his audience. So, you know, there can be... an editorial presentation.
Both the Jew and the Gentile need to use your metaphor, they need the object of their faith upgraded. Because, I mean, they could both be, again, to use the language of unseen realm, their believing loyalty is fixed on the God of Israel.
Right.
But they have to be convinced that we can shift our believing loyalty to Jesus, and it's not really a shift away from one thing to another. It's right. The same thing, but it's the same, but right. Yet it's different.
It's refocused in a certain way, right? Right? And I think it is interesting. If you look at Paul's preaching when it describes what happens when he goes to the synagogues. Mm-hmm. You know, he's showing that Jesus is the Messiah, and he's not doing the Romans road.
Yeah. John 3, well, and we talked earlier with David Capes, you know, who's one of the major figures in the early high Christology movement, you know, with Hurtado and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole, you know, the corporate things going on there as well. You know, if they're identifying Jesus with Yahweh, and I know Capes and others would say as Yahweh, and I would say that too, then they have to understand that, again, the object of the faith is actually the same, yeah, but it's still different. But they can't reject one and hold the other, right, and that be good. They have to make this transition. And everybody who's in the corporate people of God, by definition, have to make that transition.
And I would argue, I think, part of the story is they do make that transition,
yeah,
when they're presented the truth of who Jesus,
right,
is and shown
and that and that's why he's presented as the Messiah. Yeah,
and this also allows for a transitional ending to the story, at least post-apostolic, where the coming of the Spirit on these Gentile communities doesn't seem to have to continue. It can be a, mm-hmm, transitional way of God showing his hand of approval through Acts, and then I wouldn't expect it in my modern church setting, so I wouldn't even preach the coming of the Spirit passages to a modern audience. I don't think I need
to. So you would say that, okay, after a few decades of this, where it becomes clear, at least within the believing community, that the Gentiles are full heirs, again, to use Paul's language, that becomes sort of a self-evident thing. It doesn't need
Acts
repetition.
Acts 11 becomes a no-duh moment. Yes, yeah, all the Gentiles now are in. In fact, the church becomes predominantly Gentile, and thus you don't need this coming of the Spirit.
For me, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but when it comes to like churches that argue for like a current experience of, say, the baptism of the Spirit,
right,
second, you know, the second blessing or whatever, different models of that, it seems to me there's a category error because they're trying to upgrade something that's already been upgraded.
No, I think that's a way to that's a good way to put that, a category error.
So it's, you know, I mean, I appreciate part of what they're trying to get at, right? But they've already been brought into that new covenant reality. They don't need it again.
Right.
So just like I wouldn't go to my computer store and could you upgrade me to the software I already have?
Right. You're not going to have a higher status.
Right.
You're not going to have a higher membership.
So it just seems to me that's been kind of a detour that maybe was unfortunate from my perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, I have good friends in that tradition. So
yeah.
But that's at least how I process it and how I talk about it. So.
Yeah. I mean, I'm comfortable with the corporate talk because I'm not an either or guy. I'm a both and. But
you're either or guy, if you're Ron.
I don't know that he is an either. I don't know that he is an either or guy because
I'm not.
Ron gets okay. Just a personality observation. Okay? Ron is really good at detecting things that are missed or neglected or minimized, and then he grabs it and he says, "Look at this." And when people. When people listen to that, they can get the impression that he's an either or guy. It would be very easy to do that. I mean, and some of these things you may be an either or guy, but again, you want this thing to be seen and heard.
Yeah,
and so and I think it, you know, it becomes this drum.
And occasionally we can talk you down from that, right?
Yeah, my wife does too. How about indwelling of the spirits? Yeah, to me, I could also do that as a corporate issue.
See that. Yeah, and this might
gets
help.
To the Old Testament thing more. So
go, okay, how would you approach that?
The Ephesian people in Acts 19, after they experience the Spirit, they are now indwelt. Mm-hmm. That dwelling concept means he's come, he lives in this ecclesia, and so as you go home at night, you're not carrying the Spirit with you individually. You're part of a group that has the Spirit.
Can an individual quench the Spirit? I mean, because you get some of this command language.
Now, there's where I get into my personal view is the sarx pneuma back and forth of Paul strikes me as a Greek Hellenistic vertical versus horizontal way of living. And you can put small s and small f on flesh and a small s on spirit. So that living by the spirit is basically living vertically. Mm-hmm. Living by the flesh is living horizontally. And that you could have used this language on the streets of Ephesus, and they would have understood it in their dualistic world.
So like in the Old Testament, you do get this language, even though the Old Testament believers are not supposed to be indwelt.
Yeah, well, we can talk about that.
Right, you get this, they grieve the Holy Spirit. You know, you get this language.
Right.
And it's corporate, you know, when you go back, you know, in these Old Testament examples.
The nation grieved.
Yeah, spirit, like Psalm 78.
Right.
You know,
I mean, part of the challenge here, and you know, this is maybe something not so much textual, but just kind of conceptual, is we're using language like indwelling.
Right. Are we taking New Testament language and asking questions of the Old Testament?
But also, even that language, I just want to point out, it's metaphorical, right?
Yeah.
Because this is where, you know, we know it's not like the Spirit is localized in the sense that, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, we have. I'm a theology guy, sorry, but I'm going to throw those omni words, right? But God is omnipresent, right? So it's not like the Spirit before he indwells me, I've got a barrier that prevents him from being physically present.
I believed before, but I really couldn't walk with God until I had this event.
So indwelling is a metaphor for something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and we can talk about or wrestle with what that is. But it's not geography. That's
right. What if it's only to reinforce the concept? And again, our depending on how ferocious our friends are eschatologically, okay. But maybe it means nothing more than we need to take your attention away from a physical temple.
See, that's I think
to now you are sacred space.
See, that's where I think if you go back to the Old Testament, what did God indwell in the Old Testament? The tabernacle, mm-hmm. the temple,
mm-hmm.
and what was that indwelling for? It was a sign of. Relationship
of presence,
and blessing and protection
covenant
relationship and all of that. So I think indwelling in the New Testament is meant to be, and that's why Paul uses temple language too, right?
That he wants them to make the association.
It's the same kind of thing, but now it's not associated with a place. Now the sacred space, if you will, is this group of people because it's not localized.
And the whole Christ as the Spirit thing, that's part of the way the New Testament talks about this stuff. you know, where two or three are gathered, I am in your midst.
Right. Well, Christ in you. That's also there too.
Just you get that kind of language where where Christ, you know, again, my thing is just as Jesus, you know, is but isn't the Father, or he is the Father, but he's different. Mm-hmm. You know, he's the same but different. You get the same kind of thing going on with Jesus and the Spirit. Mm-hmm. And that's why we get this kind of language. It's not like replacing the Spirit or doing away with that. It's whether they're the same, but yet they're different.
And let's think of like John 14 through 17, you know, Jesus in the upper room discourse. He talks about, I'm in the Father, the Father's in me, and all of that, and I'm going to be in you, and you're going to be in me. That kind of language describes this very intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a different way of making this the same kind of point. Mm-hmm. So, again, I just, you know, what I always end up having to disabuse my students of is the geography kind of idea. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly God shows up, mm-hmm. so he's never been present. So when we get to the Old Testament, I think Old Testament believers obviously had the Spirit at work in their lives, or they couldn't be God. That's the point you made earlier, right? So so how do we describe that? Do we impose systematic theology categories on that? Which I feels to me like as a systematician, that's what's happening.
And that's where I'm...
We're trying to force the Old Testament to talk about things in ways that maybe aren't appropriate.
I've kind of drifted to that position that we are imposing categories. And
let me throw another one at you. The idea of sanctification. Old Testament, that was a precursor to worship. You'd sanctify before you entered sacred space.
Right.
Wouldn't that be the normal read of the New Testament? That sanctification doesn't happen after you're justified, as we often categorize in our theological thinking. Sanctification takes place, in my mind, in the New Testament, when the Spirit comes to Ephesus and says, these guys are clean, even as Gentiles. And now sanctification is a one-time event, thus that allows people to be and enter sacred space at will. And we shouldn't use the word thus as some kind of a progressive, getting more godly thing. That whole idea to me would be very foreign.
Yeah, it's not a defiling act for a Gentile to be in relationship.
This is another one of those systematic things where I don't think, I mean, there are more places in the New Testament where sanctified is used in kind of a definitive,
I think
already
it's,
happened.
Maybe I think it's always. I think,
but just, and maybe, that's maybe it is always.
I think it's always.
I don't have all of them, but I know the bulk of them.
How about the whole notion of, okay, when Paul either commands or states something about being conformed to the image of his son? Do you think
that to me would be more of a progressive becoming, living as though you really are what you know you are? Right. That to me is different.
In 1 John 3, there's still a future.
But does he use the word sanctify there or no?
Yeah, I don't think he does. No, I think that's why I think the terminology stuff is tricky.
Yeah.
So I don't know why systematics.
This is the will of
the word sanctification.
Well, this is the will of God. Your sanctification, I take to mean to a Thessalonian, mostly Gentile audience, it was the will of God from time immemorial that he would sanctify you Gentiles. So that's how I take Thessalonians 4:3.
But that's real consistent because the Deuteronomy 32 worldview is an aberration.
It's interesting that you mentioned that passage because I pulled it up earlier because I was thinking about it. Because right after he says this, you reject the Spirit, right? Because God has not called us to impurity but to live in holiness. And he says, God who gives you his Holy Spirit in 1 Thessalonians 8.
Now take that as a corporate
thing. And then notice what he says about brotherly love. You don't need to be to write to you because you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. That's New Covenant.
Love one another, Testament.
It's an allusion to an Old Testament, a New Testament, a New Covenant kind of language in the Old Testament. So it's the Spirit, the New Covenant, holiness. They're all kind of bound together. I mean, in this, the way Paul talks, the way he...
How do you think this helps, you know, your Old Testament... Your New Covenant language in Jeremiah 31, where it says something to the effect of, you know, no longer will someone say, know the Lord, because they will all know me. You know, it has to be corporate, but it still has to be confined to this group.
It leads to loyalty.
They all know the Lord.
I think coming out of Jeremiah 31 and the new heart idea in Ezekiel 36, in both of them, you have the result of the New Covenant being loyalty. Mm-hmm. So the problem that led to exile is now undone. What caused the exile has been changed so that now the loyalty is there. Again, it's not this behavior issue. It's not sin management. It's not, you know, the atonement issue to me. It's disloyalty, idolatry. is what's going to be the heart of the matter in the new covenant. And the promise will be, you'll know it when you see it, because the nation will now be loyal to one God.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to like about that. I don't feel, you know, any tension with that. As long as you're not saying, well, let's, you know, get rid of all the everything individual, because there's still going to be, yeah, by definition, there has to be some of that.
Some of what? I didn't.
Some, there has to be some individual sort of flavor or component somewhere, because you still have to make a decision for one thing.
Oh yeah, I mean, as far as the individuals who make up the remnant, they're going to be individual loyalists within the nation.
Yeah.
Totally. That's definitely where I'm going.
The corporate stuff makes a lot of sense.
What I'm going away from is the Reformed Protestant Western idea that I get born again by individually accepting Jesus passively, something he did on the cross or in his ministry. I'm arguing that that would have been very foreign to their thinking coming into the New Testament, that being loyal to Yahweh to them was an aggressive choice of the individual in spite of sacred space or lack of it, like a John the Baptist down by the river. He's arguing for loyalty to Yahweh.
Or a Gentile.
And so when we get to any kind of discussion about who's saved, who isn't saved, to me that's solved in the Old Testament. We're not having to rehash that in the New Testament. To me, the book of Acts and most of the epistles are about table fellowship. It's who's allowed to sit at the table as an actual heir of the kingdom. Because remember, Peter already knew that Cornelius was okay with God. He was a Gentile, you know, a God-fearer. Right. But Peter didn't think he belonged at the table. And so to me, that's the crux of the matter that Acts 11 on, and I would say Romans and
the confrontation with, you know, what Paul's rebuke to him is really about.
Yeah.
You know, this fellowship. Yeah.
I think the Damascus Road experience was a table fellowship question to Paul. Mm. That he, what do you want me to do? All three renditions of Paul's Damascus Road, the one common denominator in each one of them is, or in all three, is Gentiles. And I think that's what he struggled with. These dead, pagan, wicked people can be right with God, but they can't be right with me.
Right. And these,
I'm a Jew.
Or these Christians are defiling Yahweh
absolutely
in some way by inviting Gentiles in.
Yep. So I think that's the missing element of the Protestant Western model, is they don't put enough emphasis on the table fellowship question that should, in my mind, drive most of the discussions, even then of sanctification of the Spirit. To me, that's a Gentile, you know, they're okay at the table because they're sanctified by the Spirit. A lot of these pieces to me are answered by that.
Well, are you going to actually continue to work on this?
It'll be part of the blog.
All right. Well, I mean, I would resubmit it, too. You know? No, I would.
Yeah, I'll try. Well, why waste it on the academy, as you told me, remember?
See, there is some of that.
I know. I'm getting my own words thrown back at me here. I think it is more useful to people, you know, who would care. But, I mean, there is something to be said for having done this before your peers, and your peers are
exactly,
like, oh, it's really worth thinking.
Well, you
about.
Know what it's like, Mike and Carl, to you think something's true and you test drive it biblically and it makes sense to you and you say, I think this actually works. And then you kind of look up and say, who do I tell this to? Because if I tell it to him, he'll say it doesn't fit and just walk away. If I tell it to my church, they'll tell me to stop teaching it because it's not creedal. If I tell it to my denomination, I'll get defrocked. I mean, who do I tell it to?
Yeah.
So you can put it out in a journal and it'll sit in the back of a library. And again, maybe that's the way to go.
I like the test drive thing because a lot of people don't know that I test drove a lot of the concepts in, you know, that Unseen Realm was becoming known for. I did papers here.
Yeah.
And again, my purpose was, you know, like if there's anything I'm missing here, somebody who's interested enough to come to this paper is probably going to point it out. You know, and so I thought that was, that exercise was worth it.
I mean, there is a sense, too, where you just have to realize that for some things, because, you know, like I say, people hold on it's hard to change people's minds. Let's just be honest. Right. It's hard to change my mind. So, I mean, I'm not holding myself up as a great model, right?
We all know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so we all are like this, right? So it's just the human condition. And so one of my favorite quotes, I saw it in an article, I think it was about Noam Chomsky's views of language and whatever. It's talking about scientific progress. They borrowed this because I think I've shared this with you.
This is good.
So, you know, because... You just throw these ideas, you sow them. Some people hear them, a few people think about them, but scientific progress is made one funeral at a time.
It's true.
And I think theological progress sometimes, or biblical studies, or whatever. You know, it's just the reality is if you've been teaching something for 30 years.
Yeah. Are you going to switch?
Are you really going to switch, particularly if it involves a significant switch? I mean, you can tweak them on the margin. I can change my view of this heiress. That's not a big deal, right? But am I going to change my whole theological framework?
Do we have any examples of a well-known Millard Erickson kind of guy who's been writing for 30 years and makes a paradigm shift? And just says, I apologize, I was totally wrong.
I'll give you a small one. I don't know if this is a big one, but this is a small example. Tom Schreiner, a couple of years ago, he actually preached a message at Southern's Chapel on why he switched from amillennialism to premillennialism.
Okay.
I mean, it's a smallish one. It's not a matter of orthodoxy. But that's a pretty substantial switch. And, I mean, he did it with humbly and graciously. I think, you know, and he's a serious guy. I mean, he'd written, obviously, advocating a particular view of eschatology for a while. Says, I've changed my mind, and here's why. So there are some examples, but the bigger the issue, the harder it is, and the less likely people are to come out and say it.
This reminds me of one of the reasons when I lost my licensure or didn't get it, they had listed reasons why, and one of them was, we sense that you're prone to change your mind.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, isn't that good?
Oh, this reminds me of an email.
I didn't know how to take that.
This reminds me of an email I got once that told me they thought, though they didn't think I held a particular view, they thought I was open to the possibility of moving in that direction.
Right,
and that was kibosh. Okay,
yeah.
So you know the idea that you could be. That you could change your mind, that evidence could. I mean, here's the thing. I think we ought to not be afraid of the truth, right?
Sure.
We believe we're pursuing truth. The reality is we don't have it all right. None of us does. I mean, I love what N.T. Wright said. N.T. Wright, I heard him, I think it was at a conference a couple years ago. He said, when I began lecturing when I was young, I'd begin every class saying, 10% of what I teach you in this class is wrong. Uh-huh. I just don't know what 10%. It's because I wouldn't teach it otherwise, right?
Right.
It says, now I say 20%. You know? So, I mean, there's a certain humility in recognizing I'm wrong about some stuff. I should be willing to change my mind about certain things.
Yeah.
Do you think being under a doctrinal statement at a school subconsciously keeps you from going down a path that
Yes, it you... certainly does. I mean, anytime you're in any kind of creedal or semi-creedal condition, sometimes you just choose not to pursue it.
Right.
You have an inkling that there's something there, and you say, it's probably not profitable for me to focus my attention.
I'll get to it later.
It might be profitable.
I might lose my job. So let me focus on other areas that I think are productive that won't cost me my job. I think that's fair.
I should have thought of that earlier.
I think I'll be honest, two years ago. Yeah, right. My conversations with people over the years, I know Mike and probably you, Ron, as well, would say, I mean, I know lots of people like that. Or you know, I'm 70% sure of this thing, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
That's good enough to sign the doctrinal statement. I mean, that's and you know, I think you know, I don't
it's
think
like
I mean,
it's like sabermetrics applied to doctrinal.
I mean,
statement.
But it is a challenge, right? Because we want to be on the one hand, there's an integrity thing, right? If I totally disagree with something, I have to have integrity with that, and that's important. Yeah. I don't want to discount that, but I think we have limited time. I mean, I could study a million topics. Why would I study this one that would cost me my job? There's a bunch of other ones that are just as interesting, just as productive and useful for the church and for the academy. You know, I mean, that's okay. I mean, I don't think that's bad. It's just a kind of the real world thing. It is constraining.
I wasn't as prepared as I have experienced how being a free agent, and you've been one all your a long time, how different that feels.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you sit around, and I just turned 60 this spring, so I'm going to be an old guy.
Congratulations.
You know, yeah, it's great. But, you know, you start to say, you know, in 5 years, 10 years, you know, when my career is done, will I suddenly decide I want to think? And I don't know, but I could imagine saying maybe, I'm not quite sure what I think about that some days, you know? I mean, because I wrestle with that because I want to be a person of integrity, and I, you know, but I also believe in truth, and I believe in pursuing truth, and I don't think there's anything wrong with pursuing truth, and I'm not afraid of the truth. I think some people are afraid of the truth because it might not match up with their ideas they already have.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not afraid. I refuse to be afraid of the truth.
Yeah.
So
that's a good note to end on, especially with our audience, because, you know, that's basically what we do. You know, we try to examine things, look at things, probe it. Yeah, you know, 2 years down the road, we might discover something new, and that's good. You know, that's good. It's not like an indictment on, oh, we really thought poorly 2 years ago. No, we...
Well, sometimes we did.
But. You know, there are a few times, but sometimes there is this one little nugget that really you know, takes you in one direction or the other, and you're not aware of it.
And so, I'd like to say, you know, even here, as I've told you personally, I've noticed in your clientele, the people that listen to you, it is an incredibly astute group. And I'm honored whenever I email with someone, I'm always amazed at how careful thinking they are. And if they disagree, they do it lightly, which I wasn't used to.
They're not going to go tell their mom.
Yep. I mean, I would say things in class and get back to my office and get a phone call from their parents before I stepped in the door sometimes. Yeah. And I got so gun shy after a while. But thank you.
Good. Well, thanks again this year for sharing with us.
I know you get, glad to be here.
There's lots of papers you could go to, lots of other things you could have, lots of other arguments.
Papers, what's that, Mike? Yep.
The things that Ron gets, you know,
turned down for. That's why I don't go.
We'll try again. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the annual meetings of the Evangelical Theological Society. This is our last day. And I think this is our last interview of the day. And we're thrilled to have Carl Kootz with us and Rebecca Jasperger. If you have listened to the interviews up to this point, you know that they have written a Hebrew grammar, because I've mentioned it before, and I'm enthusiastic about it. I'm endorsing it. Just go out and buy it. I mean, all that good stuff. But we wanted to have them on so that they can talk about, again, their own work, sort of how it was born, what's different about it. But before we get into that, I want to ask each of them to introduce themselves, tell our audience, you know, who you are, you know, what you're doing, you know, what, just, you know, give us a little brief bio for each of you so that, you know, they're oriented in some way.
Okay. Hi, I'm Becky Jasperger. I currently teach at Multnomah University in Portland, Oregon. I teach Old Testament and Hebrew, and I love what I teach.
That helps.
Yeah. Oh, man. I really enjoy it. But I graduated from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I did my dissertation under Dr. Daniel Block about, 10, 11, 12 years ago. And since then, I've been at Multnomah. This is my 10th year. And interesting tidbit about me, I've worked on some grammars as editor and TA and things like that before, but I always swore I would never write one. So that, yeah, I'm very, very, very proud of this one, though. We've been working on it for about 9 years. So,
and I'm Carl Kootz. I teach at Multnomah University as well. I did my PhD studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison under Michael Fox and focused on Hebrew Scriptures and Septuagint. I've been at Multnomah now for 21 years and am chair of the Biblical Languages Department.
That just really made me feel old.
I'm sorry about that, you know, Mike.
I mean, because I had you for what was the second year, you know, what was marketed by the department as the second year Hebrew.
Yeah.
I can't believe you've been there for 20
years. And let me ask you, since Carl was your teacher, do you still read Hebrew?
Oh, yeah.
I ask everyone who had Carl. That's my number one goal.
it was a good class. And the thing that sort of stood out to me was sort of your, because we had to do this, you know, the reproduction method, you know, reproducing forms. And even if you don't, you know, you're not spending time every day reproducing forms, the principles of it, you know, are still relevant, you know, just for parsing and things like that. Yeah. So before we go ahead,
I just wanted to clarify that I have read your work and I already know you read Hebrew. Okay. But it is the number one question I want to know when...
Points for you.
Thank you. It's the number one question I ask when I hear that someone's been Carl's student, because Hebrew is often considered a very difficult course. And in my observation, it's been one of the least used courses post-graduation, unless someone's going on to get a dissertation in that topic or something.
And I think Becky's question really answers part of what drives this grammar. When I was a graduate student teacher at the University of Wisconsin years ago, I was, you know, first teaching Hebrew, and there was a couple of things that really made a difference for me. One was Paul Manuel's work on the vowel changes in biblical Hebrew that, for me, just explained why things happened. And I thought, you know what, if beginning students could experience this information in a way that was brought to their level as a first-year student, it would alleviate a lot of memorization and help them understand why Hebrew worked the way it did, so that it would promote long-term retention.
Yeah.
And then the second issue was I had searched and searched to find a Hebrew grammar that had an extensive translation set of exercises. Mm-hmm. And Weingreen was really the only thing that was available that had that. And so we really wanted to capture getting students into the text early, having lots of translation so that you can have the kinds of dynamic dialogue about text, about understanding translation, about seeing them in the process of trying to figure out how Hebrew works, and to do so in a way that if life just gets in the way when they come back to Hebrew, they're not trying to face this daunting task of rememorizing loads of forms, but understanding it so that it comes back quickly.
Yeah. My brain is going off like fireworks because there's so many things I want to say. But one of the questions we get is, why is your grammar distinct? Because one thing we did before we ended up finding Lexham was go around and talk to publishers about producing this grammar years ago. And what we found was there are already too many. So why another one?
We've got one of those.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I said already that I really didn't ever want to write one. But after being here at Multnomah for a while, seeing that it worked, and one of the things that makes it so unique is Carl mentioned cutting down on memorization. But our students will sometimes complain about memorization, which is basically one paradigm, a couple of forms, four per paradigm for all the rest of the strong forms and vocabulary, and we'll go in and show them all of the paradigms that we had to memorize.
Is that what you do? You show them the other grammar.
So this is your choice. You may learn these, or you may continue this way. And their complaint is always good-hearted. I'm interjecting this. I'll get to the second thing I was going to say in a second. But man, the way the students love Hebrew is what has me most excited about it. And this is the second piece, by the fourth week of first year, they're reading about a chapter at a time of graded biblical Hebrew, the Joseph narrative, one chapter a week, so it's a continuous story. This has never happened before, but we had a very quirky class yesterday before I left, and I walked into the classroom, and the students had built a fort. This is college and graduate students. They had brought blankets in. They were over the tables and chairs, and we sat under the fort because it's that time of year, and everyone's tired. But we were just, it was a goofy, but it was great because we were laughing about, like, what gave this idea? And they said, this is our favorite thing we do, and we want to be comfortable and have fun while we're doing it. Reading Hebrew is your favorite activity of the week. Yeah. And that's how I feel about it. But these are not all Bible students. These are counseling students, TESOL students, spousal enrichment. Hebrew is not required anywhere. We're at our school. But they were reading, I think it's chapter 44 or chapter 45 of Genesis, almost straight biblical Hebrew at that point. And they just said, we get to get caught up in the story. And then we see the grammar concept you were talking about, and it finally makes sense, which is also an encouragement that you don't have to teach very well for it to work. But it's so fun for them.
So, you're at the university, and if you mentioned it's not required, so these are undergrads?
Graduate and undergrad. They're merged in our program.
We merged the program about 10 years ago, and we blended undergrads and grads in the same classroom. The undergrads have 4 credit hours, and the grads 3 credit hours for a 4-hour per week course.
Okay.
It's been an incredible opportunity because the grad students tend to be OCD. They can parse like nobody's business. The undergrads always struggle with parsing, but they can read the socks off of a grad student any day of the week. And wow. The blend has created a what they call the Hebrew family. They get together, they read together, and they mutually complement each other's strengths to where they begin to see things actually related to life, that you don't have to try and become somebody else. You can capitalize on your strengths. You can bolster your weaknesses. But collectively, they just keep falling in love with Hebrew. And although it's an elective program, mm-hmm. we offer 14 semesters of Hebrew, and we have typically between 15 and 30 in our opening Hebrew classes.
That is really crazy.
Awesome. I mean,
for an elective course of really anything, you know, to have a consistent number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all the way to, how many are you in your
And I have a division? Job elective right now that's a advanced seminar, and we have 6 in there.
Yeah, and I had an advanced Deuteronomy, and we had 12 last semester, or last year, so all year. So they really stick with it. They love it. They'll audit it sometimes just to be part of it because they've fallen in love with Scripture.
We had one student who was an MDiv student, and she got excited about Hebrew. She audited it first. We just kind of talked her into trying it.
Yeah.
She fell in love with it, enrolled in the MDiv program, and we had to keep convincing her she ought to get to her main curriculum. She took every Hebrew class we offer except for one, Rabbinic Hebrew. It took her a few years to finish her MDiv, but yeah. She just absolutely fell in love with the Hebrew language and communicating it to other people. And our advanced students love to spend time with beginning students, and we have kind of a life-on-life mentoring that goes on where we pour our lives into the students, but then the students in turn just do life with one another, and they augment what's going on.
Do you have any concern about, you know, other professors adopting your grammar?
Not at all.
Okay. I do.
Okay, you do?
No, of course you don't. You're great at marketing. I do.
I mean, because
I have a couple.
There's some personal flavoring going on.
Well, one of the things is the community piece. We have tried to convey that in the instructor guide that we're working on right now. We do a couple things uniquely. Students translate 5 hours a week, and that's it. And then they draw a line. And I don't care if they got 3 verses or finished the chapter. As long as there's improvement and encouragement and lack of frustration. So we set goals. We know what language acquisition is like. And
it's long term, and you don't have to spend 15 hours a week on it in order to make it happen. In fact, in the classroom, we want to be able to see the student in action when they're puzzled, when they're up against a text that they've never seen before, so that we can figure out how their brains work and how to help them as an individual clarify how they approach it.
Are they graded on the amount that they do?
Of course not. Yes, they are. 5 hours, 100%.
Okay, so your amount is time, not lines.
Yeah, it's time and method. And this is the other piece. There has to be room to fail. So the method that we our answer key is in our exercise book, and Lexham kind of pushed back on that. But in order to be a good teacher, in order to be taught, the teacher has to have the student has to have a desire for that information.
Yeah.
And when you're wrestling through something and you want to know the answer, that is the time to tell them what it is. The next week in class, they may have forgotten what they were even struggling with. So we have students, in brief, we just have them translate in pencil. We have them then go back and correct their work in pen. And any correction they make that they do not understand after they've seen the error, they highlight that. So then we know their level of comprehension. Because how many times have you gone to parse a word, not known what it was, looked it up, found it, and thought, I knew that.
So the student typically enters the classroom with having read the passage in terms of translation, having corrected it based on what they saw, annotated it to try and figure out what they missed or whatever, and then as we enter the classroom, we're going back over the same material on some level, but the types of questions are incrementally beyond just that opening encounter with the text.
Yeah, unless they can't word their question,
right,
which is what the highlighting helps us with. We can look at the page and go, oh, I bet you were confused because this is a guttural.
So, okay, the handbook for instructors is in progress.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And what's the timetable for that?
The workbook itself is supposed to be out in the beginning months of this new year. The instructor guide should be out by the end of the spring.
Is that a saleable, or are you going to? Do you have a companion website for the product?
We have to check with our publisher.
Okay.
No idea.
Yeah, how that works.
Because that seems to be.
Yeah. It's a very important.
Let's be honest. Instructors expect to get things for free.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Well, so, let's be honest. You know. We asked Lexham to publish this and sell it for as inexpensively as possible because we feel the pinch. But yeah, the other piece of that instructor guide, you asked about fear of other people teaching it. I won't give the whole backstory, but when I came to Southern, I had lots of Hebrew from excellent instructors, but I knew there was a lot I didn't understand. And then I'm a brand new teacher, female on top of that, rather young at the time, and you have to hold some sense of confidence, and yet I felt none. And I knew there were things I didn't understand. One of the things that Carl did as a mentor, although he acted like he wasn't a mentor, but he was give me the space to figure out that I was safe and I could finally ask questions about why something worked the way it did without someone thinking I don't know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And that took probably about a year for me. To even ask a question or venture to translate something on site, even though I was teaching it, it's scary. In the classroom, you can prepare for that. For the student and the teacher, there has to be a freedom to fail and make mistakes. And even in the classroom, I think one of the reasons our students believe they can do it is because they know me well enough to know that if I can, they can. Mm-hmm. And it makes a huge difference for the student, and professors are going to have to be willing to look at something and say, gosh, I'm learning some of this along with everyone else. Mm-hmm. There are the first five chapters besides the alphabet and the sound of the vowels were pretty much all new to me when I started teaching in this program.
Yeah. And I think that's why my initial answer when you asked the question about is this transferable to other instructors was yes, because from my vantage point, the issue is not trying to create something that displaces everything else as much as to offer something that can constantly be morphing to meet the needs of profs with whatever obstacles they might find in implementing it. I mean, this is an ongoing conversation for us. I've been committed to thinking about teaching Hebrew for almost 30 years, and it's not going to stop with the publication of the grammar. As we move forward, we want to be able to offer resources that help people understand why we do what we do. There are so many little parts to even the way the textbook is laid out that if we had the time to explain the pedagogy behind that, would play a minor role in everything that happens. And so I think the instructor guide, you know, I envision email conversations and phone conversations with people to try and help in whatever way to make this as accessible as possible. And I just hope people fall in love with it just because their students get into the text early, they read a lot, they get excited about the biblical text, and the kinds of questions they have are augmented because of it. One other thing I might add is that because the graded reader of the Joseph narrative preserves as much of the MT as possible, they're being confronted with Hebrew idioms and cultural items from the very outset. And they're very aware of the fact that it's a cross-cultural experience at every stage of the process. And we have some amazing conversations about what translation is and how it works and how do you perceive Hebrew idioms and the way that they look at either syntax or just ideas. And it's been incredibly rich that way.
Have you guys considered, and I don't know I don't know how Multnomah looks at recording. I'm talking about video here. What goes on in a classroom and putting it on a website for free.
Right.
But the reason I bring this up is if I want to know how you would assess a lot of this is interactivity, what goes on in the classroom. What about the independent learner? Somebody says, I just want to learn Hebrew. I want to buy this grammar. Right.
Well, that's why we
self-teach.
That's why we wrote it the way we did.
Yes.
Because both of us were self-learners, at least for the first initial beginning of Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Carl was a successful self-learner. I was a unsuccessful self-learner. But we wrote so that our students, if they're driven and willing to work at something, yes, we have a number already that have done that.
And the grammar
the interactivity is what I was.
Yes, wondering. Well, the grammar is set for the publishing of the workbook here in the next few months.
Yeah.
Once that is firmed in terms of its digital format, it is going into a digital version that will include audio recordings of every translation, every Hebrew word in the entire grammar and workbook. It will also have interactive videos, animations that depict the historical development of Hebrew, how to read Hebrew aloud and understand it. And I think in the long run, I think the potential for instructional videos or things that can augment that is definitely on the table.
I do too. The one thing I want to be careful of is ever giving the idea that there's only one right way to teach Hebrew, because there's not.
No.
And just like we believe that each student in our classroom is able to learn the language at a different rate, for sure, but they all speak at least one language. So they all have language acquisition skills. It might take a little longer, but they can learn it. I also think that instructors can all teach, and they don't have to look like I do. I hope they don't look like I do in the classroom. And they don't have to look like Carl looks in the classroom. Our styles of teaching are incredibly different. He lectures for about 20 minutes. And
then I do most of it inductively as we're going through the passage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Becky tends to...
Oh, I've got to see every eye in that classroom light up. And I'll slow down and we'll do it again. And it can be obnoxious sometimes. But each of us spend about an hour a week in... Well, 20 minutes or an hour in the grammar portion, and then 3 hours of just reading. But you can have everybody has their own strengths. Language is relational, and it's built for relationship. And I think we lose that piece so often in the way that we teach languages. So other constructors can teach it.
One thing that might also be helpful to mention is that the grammar, because it weaves in so many advanced concepts in a fundamental way from the very beginning, we are very aware of the fact that the book not only introduces the student to the points that they need to take away from each chapter, but it's layering things that we see payout for long down the road. In fact, in some cases, our students will be in their third semester or fourth semester of Hebrew, and they'll look at us and think, oh, that's what a PL does. You know. And so we recognize that there are elements where we're just laying groundwork. And that may be one of the more difficult aspects of the grammar, is that if an instructor is more used to a grammar that only gives the student what they can digest at that moment and then waits, they might feel a bit overwhelmed by the information that's in there. They'll need to navigate and say, you know, at this point, the student needs to know the noun endings and the suffixes for pronouns, boom, you know, and then the verb paradigm, and that's the bottom line, and a student can do just fine with that. But there's so much else there that whether the student assimilates it at that point because they happen to be linguistically adept, or whether it starts to pay out two semesters later, I think that's the beauty of what's in the grammar.
Well, thanks for spending some time with us. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I intend to read through the whole thing. You know, and just hearing again, I can identify with what you're saying, because, you know, there you are in a classroom. I have a PhD in Hebrew Bible.
I was hired to teach Hebrew.
and it's like, There are things I really don't know or understand. I mean, it's just, you got to know everybody feels that way, but you're not supposed to convey that in any way. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm quite sure, you know, it'll be both a refresher, you know, to again, mm-hmm. some of the things you did, you know, in our second year class, and just picking up again these explanatory, these little connectives, mm-hmm. you know, that you can connect one thing to the other. So I mean, that's my intention. So for our audience, again, we get questions a lot, you know, how can I learn Greek? How can I learn Hebrew? And it's really nice, you know, to be able to recommend this one. You know, because I feel like I have some, you know, minimal experience with it.
Right.
But again, you know, we here, as going through the UW program, you get students from Multnomah, and you know, you were there, and you know, there's this impression, I'm sure you've heard this, there was this impression among many students that the people who went through this particular program just seemed to have it down a little bit better for some reason.
Because they do.
Right. And so that again, that's one of the reasons I mean, years ago we had this conversation about you, mm-hmm. you know, considering Lexham for your grammar. So now I finally get to say, well, there it is. Mm-hmm. So go get it.
Well, right. And one more comment too. We talked about this in our faculty meeting yesterday. Multnomah Hebrew has turned out some exceptional students. I'm just, wow.
People teaching at prestigious universities. Mm-hmm. But that's not the only student we're targeting. I remember at the University of Wisconsin.
You're not just looking for your doctoral protege.
No, we're not. In fact, at the University of Wisconsin, one of the students that's always been on my mind was somebody who came to me and said, the university gave me an exemption from language because I have a fourth grade reading acquisition level, but I want to learn Hebrew. And I saw him go on and learn Hebrew, and the learning of Hebrew and the way we were doing it in the classroom actually changed his mode of learning in other classes. And he eventually went on and got a master's degree in national defense and went on to work for the State Department.
And we have one of those right now.
Right now.
And she's here beginning interview process for PhD programs in Hebrew and Old Testament.
I never thought she would go there.
And she's amazing. And she's also our best tutor because our first and second year students who feel like they aren't getting it because there's so much each week thrown at them. She just says, I didn't get it then either. It's okay. Can you write this paradigm and can you read this translation?
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you know, there's always been this tendency to think that if somebody's going into ministry, what you do is you give them the minimum amount that they need so that they can kind of get the gist of it and then use it. But you can't use it if you don't understand it. And so the other side of what happens in our classroom is that we've got people who are, they're not thinking about graduate school at all. They just want to do ministry. They want to be a pastor or they want to be involved in some other kind of ministry while they have a marketplace job. And they develop the skills so that they can just be equipped as individuals. And I think that's some of the most exciting part of what goes on.
Well, thanks again. I'm glad we did this.
Thank
very
you.
Welcome.
Glad you guys
thanks.
Could make it right off the plane.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Mike. I always enjoy listening to you, Ron, and Carl talk. It's always fun to watch you three just talk shop.
Yeah, we go back a long way, so we can poke each other in the eye in a fun way, and we always do.
It's very entertaining. All right, we appreciate it. All right, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.